Greetings, this is James Gunn with As You Wish Talk Radio, broadcasting live from beautiful Trout Lake, Washington. We've got quite a lot of things in the news lately. It seems like our new president is really pushing the science card, and according to a lot of the inside people and Dr. Sala with exopolitics.org and Alfred Weber with exopolitics.com, both of them are saying that looks like he's ready to break loose the anti-gravity and the some of the other fuelless energy technologies and start turning this planet around. So we'll see, you know, what's going to happen with that. And probably one of the best spokesmen for that is Joel Garbin, who just finished a book, Breakthrough Energy. And rather than stepping around this subject, let's just bring Joel on right now. Joel, are you with us?
Yeah, hi, James. Good evening.
Joel, great to have you with us again.
Oh, thanks. I really appreciate you having me on.
Have you followed this, a lot of the disclosures that Obama is making and sending out over the Internet concerning, you know, their desires to start bringing forward all these new technologies?
Well, yeah, we have been following this. You know, there's some really encouraging signs that finally we're going to have an administration that's going to collaborate to progress things instead of having this stagnant or even retrograde type of atmosphere that we've had here the last number of years. It's really time that we show some maturity as a society, not just here in the United States, but globally as well. And I think that this is a remarkable opportunity for the Obama administration to really seize on a critical moment in our history, not just here in the United States, but actually in the global scene here. We have so many challenges that are facing us as a human civilization, and we need real leadership to emerge. Unfortunately, there's been a real lack of true leadership. And now it does look like things are opening up. You know, we're seeing that the new administration is soliciting the opinions and insights and ideas of the citizens. And it's been a long time since that's happened. And I think people around the world are taking note of that. And it's offering a lot of hope and encouragement to people. And, you know, it's not just in the areas of science and technology, although that'll be the focus of our discussion here, I'm sure. But it's in these other issues. It's in you know, how do nations dialogue with each other? How are the geopolitical elements massaged and progressed? You know, how are the socioeconomic policies, especially maybe the economic side right now, how do we address these things? Collaboratively, cooperatively, not just, you know, one nation trying to stamp its footprint around the planet. So there's a really unique opportunity. I hope that the apparent sincerity continues to be the case with Obama and his transition team.
You know, it seems that, you know, it is definitely we've kind of gotten rid of, I wouldn't say, not so much resistant administration, but one that seemed to make a lot of people go away or turned a blind eye to some of the things that happened to a lot of the, you know, the major inventors that had these technologies and a lot of these alternative energy technologies. They just kept disappearing one after another. And I believe it was, was it Gene Maloff or what was his first name?
Well, yeah, Eugene Maloff.
Yeah, Maloff.
I mean, Eugene Maloff was a true champion of the advanced new energy technologies. He had been a chief science editor at MIT and was closely watching the how the announcement of the cold fusion technology, which came out in 1989 by Fleshman and Pons, who were out at in Utah. You know, they made the announcement of this groundbreaking discovery of being able to produce a tremendous amount of excess energy, essentially in a tabletop experiment that produced no harmful radiation, and it was showing evidence of true fusion, true nuclear reaction, similar to what occurs inside a star like our sun. Well, you know, shortly after that announcement, scientists at MIT, primarily those nuclear physicists who are involved in the hot fusion program, which has used tens of billions of dollars of U.S. taxpayer money to try to simulate what happens inside a star to produce energy. They tried to replicate the cold fusion experiments and claimed that it was not replicable, basically held press conferences that suggested that this was all a hoax, that it was fraudulent science, and that the cold fusion should die. And, of course, the media picked up on that. And, you know, being that, you know, scientists at MIT and places like Princeton and other very top-flight, highly credentialed universities, I mean, these guys are considered the lords of science.
Mm-hmm.
So they really have the media at their beck and call. And when they claim something to be thus, it tends to be accepted, you know, just as stated. So cold fusion basically was, you know, blazoned throughout the press as a hoax. And that's what got seeded into the public consciousness. Well, you know, Eugene Maloff was watching this closely. He asked for the data from the MIT scientists, being, you know, at MIT himself and being a scientist in his own right. And he kept being stonewalled. Finally, he got the data through some backdoor methods, you know, did the analysis on the data and found that there had been some doctoring of MIT's own data. They did not report all of the data, specifically the points in their replication experiments that showed they were getting these anomalous excess energy outputs from their own experiments. But they did not report that data. Essentially, they lied.
Mm-hmm.
And that breach of ethics caused Eugene Maloff to resign from the university in protest. He went on to start Infinite Energy Magazine, which continues to this day to be a front-running publication that documents what's going on in the new energy field. And he also established the New Energy Laboratories there in New Hampshire, which opened the door to these pioneering inventors to come and demonstrate their technologies and be assessed with a high degree of technical rigor so that the public and investors could know whether the technology really had merit. Well, Eugene Maloff became a strong proponent of the real cold fusion science and other technologies as well. Unfortunately, in the spring of 2004, he was murdered, and you know, it was a very, very sad day for those of us who are in the new energy field here, because he's been such a champion. And in fact, we ended up dedicating our first new energy movement conference in Portland, Oregon, in Eugene's memory. But you know, the crime has never been solved. There were a couple suspects who were held, actually for, I believe they were in custody actually for maybe a couple of years. But just recently, you know, they were released, and no charges, standing charges, I guess, were brought forth. They were essentially let go, and now the crime essentially remains a mystery. So, you know, who knows what really happened there? It was a great loss, Eugene Maloff's death. But, you know, we go on. We, you know, we respect and honor the things that he did that were great, that blazed some trails and opened some doors, but we move on. You know, there's any number of obstacles that, you know, that can get in the way of the advancement of clean and quantum leap type of new energy technologies. You know, but we can't get too focused on acts of desperation and suppression and things like that.
I think, from what I've heard, basically from a lot of the top people in the new energy field or alternative energy field, you know, a lot of them are saying that a lot of the, you know, the heavy suppression has seemed to stop. And now they said basically it's getting down to the people just learning to work together within the movement.
I think that's quite accurate, James. You know, I've seen here recently, in fact, even just two nights ago, I was in Hawaii, on the island of Kauai, having dinner with a couple of physicists, Roger Stringham, who's a pioneer in the sonofusion technology, which I'll describe later, and then Nassim Paramain, who has a technology that that basically would eventually have applications for space drive, a type of anti-gravity and new energy propulsion type of technology. And we're sitting around dinner talking about some of these things and what the obstacles have been. And basically what, you know, what we decided was that it looks like more the challenge has been funding coming forward for these technologies. And maybe not so much the heavy-handed suppression of times past. There certainly are a lot of opportunities to help further these technologies, but it does require that there be teams of engineers, you know, teams of people who know how to take the technology through the engineering cycles and into the public domain as a commercial product. And that takes money. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen is that the venture capital community, as much as they have poured a lot of money into wind and solar and biofuels and tidal power, all of these we consider conventional renewable technologies. They've been around for a long time. They have great promise, yes, and they do produce clean energy, yes, we agree with that. They have some drawbacks as well, however. But from the funding side, these things are well known, well established. There's really no mystery there at all. They all follow very conventional science. Well, when it comes to some of these advanced new energy technologies, some of which challenge accepted conventions in physics and chemistry, suddenly you find that the investment community is very, very reticent about putting any capital toward these technologies. And the reason for that generally is because when there are investments in science and technology, generally there are advisors, science advisors, that are brought, you know, to the investor, and their opinion is expressed on the merit of the technology. Well, when you have something like, you know, an advanced energy technology, and its operating principles seem to violate accepted theories of thermodynamics, conservation of energy, these you know, kind of foundational principles, but yet they still produce very measurable excess energy in their operation. Well, it's hard to find any of the mainstream academic scientists who are experts in this. In fact, most of them have no knowledge of it at all, and it's very daunting to them and probably somewhat personally threatening to them to acknowledge that they lack expertise in this field. So generally what their recommendation to the financial people is a thumbs down, because they don't understand it. They're not willing to put the reputation on the line by endorsing it. So that remains a door that's very difficult to wedge open. It's one of the major reasons why the nonprofit that I run, which is called the New Energy Movement, folks can see that at newenergymovement.org on the website. We have a program that's called Inventor Booster Grant. And basically what that's designed to do is to use donations from the public to help get financial resources toward the technologies of merit that are being brought forward by various inventors. And it certainly isn't something that can take them the whole distance, but in targeted situations. It's enough to help, again, give a boost to the inventor. For instance, there's an inventor in Seattle who approached us in the month of May this past summer, who presented a very compelling technology to Gene Manning and myself. And he showed us some of the affidavits from his work, where he had had two separate third-party engineering laboratories that had established that his technology provided excess energy above and beyond the amount of input energy to get the device working. And classically, that would be called an over-unity energy device. And he had two different affidavits that showed that. And in his description of the technology, it's very, very compelling. And we felt that this merited our support. So we provided him the first New Energy Movement Inventor Booster Grant so that he could buy some materials to work up a good demonstrator device that could be shown to the public, and also buy test equipment to help do the testing as he goes through the prototype stage. So, you know, we're excited about that type of program. We definitely need to have the public become very educated about all these tremendous opportunities that there are for clean, advanced energy technologies that can leapfrog the conventional renewables of wind and solar and biofuels, because we have to turn over every stone right mm-hmm. now. We can't rely on just one category of technology. Certainly can't keep relying on the dominant fossil fuel and nuclear infrastructures. We must start moving away from those type of energy generation approaches very aggressively.
No, we had to. I don't know if you followed Stanley Meyer's work. I'm sure you did, but he, you know, actually split water, and he was running, you know, his little dune buggy on that for quite some time, and demonstrated over and over again. And then he gave the technology, had a big meeting with the military, and, you know, show them how they could run their Humvees and their tanks on water. And then next thing you know, he ends up dead as well. You know, the just soon after that, just right after the big dinner party.
Yeah, his story is a real fascinating one. I never had the chance to meet Stan Meyer. Gene Manning, my co-author of our book Breakthrough Power, she did have a chance to meet Stan on a few occasions and had several conversations with him, and much of that is documented in our book Breakthrough Power. And you know, he had, with that technology, the water splitting technology, apparently was getting about 90 miles per gallon using water as the fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the patents that he had on that have become public domain, and it's widely thought that as inventors often will do, they put just enough in the patent to be granted and be issued the patent, but they oftentimes hold back some trade secrets that actually make the thing a robust device. And apparently Stan Meyer may have done the same thing.
Well, I think his brother is continuing with the work and you know, continuing to push forward to get this technology out. So it should be interesting where that goes. And I know several other inventors I've talked to that say they have it down. I know, you know, you can buy a lot of these kits, and unfortunately they just don't work, you know, up to the expectations that they say. Like, you'll increase your gas mileage, you know, 50% and even more. And some say they're running their whole car on water. But, you know, so far those haven't really panned out. But supposedly there are a couple people that are getting those results, and they are, you know, some of them are running their cars on 100% water. They've found out how to split it on demand.
Yeah, I've heard some of those anecdotes. I have not yet seen one of those technologies myself.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree with you that, some of these kits may not deliver quite what the promises are, you know, but the thing about the water is fuel enthusiasm, and I share it. I think it's a wonderful thing to be researched, and I do believe that there are some working devices where they have figured out how to split water using resonant frequencies rather than using the kind of brute force electrolytic, you know, just pumping current into the water, you know, with some electrodes and breaking it down into hydrogen and oxygen. I think that there's more elegant technologies for splitting the water into usable fuel by tickling the molecules apart using the proper resonant frequencies that that will split the molecules. You know, just because I haven't seen one personally doesn't mean that they don't exist. But even the fact that some of these regular electrolytic approaches for generating hydrogen or generating what's called hydroxy gas, otherwise known as Brown's gas, there's a lot of these Brown's gas generator retrofit devices that are out there now that people can use to supplement and do hydrogen boosting of a conventional internal combustion engine. And they do get better performance. Certainly it does help the regular hydrocarbon fuel, the gasoline, the diesel, burn more cleanly. And maybe the biggest benefit there may be that it has launched a tremendous wave of enthusiasm of some research and tinkering and good old-fashioned inventorship. And, you know, I really love that. I love to see that people of all stripes are you know, digging in and looking for a way to crack this nut and give us something that's really clean and robust, that's inexpensive, that works, and that doesn't have a nasty environmental input.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many technologies I've been following, and I know both of us know one inventor, we won't really mention his name here on the air, that had some pretty amazing technologies. And I got to hold some of these technologies in my hand and watch them work and just plug in one thing after another to them, you know, 500-watt lights and sanders and drills, and just kept going and going. And Walter Rosenthal was present when we did this as well. He was one of the main rocket men, you know, from NASA, mm-hmm. one of the rocket scientists. They call him the Rocket Man, basically. And mm-hmm. unfortunately, he's dead as well. But
Walter was very, very well known and well respected. So when he did the technical assessment, it had some real mm-hmm. Some real weight to it.
And, you know, I was there, and our friend gave him, you know, the invention. He says, if you can figure it out, you can have it. If you can figure out how this works, you can have it. Because it breaks every known law of physics, and there are no books for this. You know, there's no, you have to rewrite the books and rewrite the physics to really understand this. And he spent about a week on it and could not figure out how it worked because it's so far outside of the box that you can't apply any of the known physics to this device, but it had an enormous output of energy, and it looks like it's getting time for these to come out. And it's not just fuelless energy, but you know they're anti-gravity and counter-gravity devices and things of that nature. And you know some of them are so small you could put a little unit on the back of your refrigerator and it would make it mobile. You wouldn't even have to plug with it. So
I think you're right. I think you're right about the time being ripe for these things finally to emerge into the public awareness and into the public domain as commercial devices. You know, one reason for that, I believe, is that we have a generation of young people, a couple generations of young people now, who are able to embrace new ideas with a higher level of adaptation and comprehension of technology that just so far surpasses what was the case in my generation and the one that preceded me, that I think that having a breakthrough energy technology really is no big deal to these younger ones. And so that brings a lot of hope and promise that we can make this transition very quickly. I mean, hand one of these, you know, hand a, you know, an iPod or an iPhone or whatever gadget that, you know, that gets spit out and into the hands of a 7-year-old, and watch how fast these kids master this thing. It just is mind-boggling, because they have such an ease and grace as far as comprehending the technology, and they integrate it into their daily activities very seamlessly. And you know, it's such a contrast to how those who I refer to as the lords of science, you know, kind of the stodgy mainstream academic community that feels very threatened when one of these challenging new theories threatens their, you know, kind of their pet conventional theories. Usually a lot of these researchers have had, you know, much of their career, the grants that have been issued to them to fund their own work. Most of these have been along fairly, you know, traditional lines of physics and chemistry. Well, when all of a sudden there's something that would leapfrog their own understanding, they become very threatened by that. And that's a very normal human experience. And certainly we all have felt at times, you know, what it's like to feel afraid. Because something that we trust in, that we believe in, something that perhaps supports us materially, whether it's in our job or some other stream of income, when all of a sudden we see that something's coming along that might make that obsolete, that oftentimes is really puts people in fear. I've felt that myself when I had to make a career change. You know, and it was tough till I came to grips with that I needed to embrace the change and move ahead. It was a real challenge for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a very common human experience. So I have a lot of empathy for the ones who may have been obstructing the breakthrough technologies because they felt threatened. Even if they've been a vested interest from the corporate world, you know, from the oil infrastructure or nuclear infrastructure or some political element, you know, I do have some empathy for
yeah.
them. Now, I also would point out, though, that we need to exercise wisdom. We need to have the collective good in mind. We can't allow our own selfish interest and narrow self-interest allow us to drive our train right off of the cliff. You know, we've got to make the right choices, because that's the only way we're going to be able to correct the imbalances that exist on our planet, whether they're the environmental issues with all the pollution and the decline of forests and animal species and marine species, whether it's the climate change issue, whether it's the huge disparities in living conditions and resources among all the nations of the world, and on and on and on. I mean, there's so many imbalances that we need to correct. So
you mind,
Jason?
I think we have a caller online here.
Yes.
Do we have a caller?
Yes. Hello. How are you doing?
Yeah. Can you state your name and where you're calling from?
This is Ramon from New York.
How are you doing, Ramon?
How's it going?
Did you have a question concerning the new technologies?
Yes. I actually wanted to ask you a question about when you were talking about making water resonate instead of, like, pumping away electricity, as what most people would think to do. I know Nikola Tesla believed that everything had a frequency, and according to rumor, he made, like, a whole building vibrate just through, like, this little machine that was vibrating, finding the right frequency. So is that pretty much what you would need to do with water, is vibrate it at its own frequency and then make it separate?
Well, that is the approach exactly that's being taken by the researchers who've been using resonant frequencies. You know, a good resource for you to learn some more about this would be to go to one of our sister organization's website, which is the New Energy Congress. If you go to newenergycongress.org and you use the search engine for water as fuel, you'll find a tremendous amount of resources there about how these different inventors are approaching this. One who you should focus on is a gentleman named Bob Boyce, B-O-Y-C-E. And Bob has done a lot of research on using resonant frequencies for water splitting. But the Tesla principle, I believe, is accurate. You don't need to take a hammer to split something apart when tickling it will coax it apart. The energy input doesn't need to be a dramatic amount. It could be something that's very subtle and gets the job done. And so that's basically the analogy that we're using here for doing water splitting using resonant frequencies.
My other comment was when these inventors have these new energies, why don't they just bootleg it or sell it in the black market? Because, I mean, you have things that are not good for you that you can find in the black market. Why not distribute it that way?
Well, that's a very good question. And, you know, what this brings up, and it's something that we write about in our book, Breakthrough Power, is the idea of open sourcing a technology as opposed to using kind of a standard business model where the researcher patents the technology and licenses the technology to some manufacturer, and it gradually makes its way out into the market in some limited way, and it takes quite a while for it to gain acceptance and much exposure in the marketplace. And there's a lot of hurdles that usually you have to go through along the way, not the least of which is the patent process itself oftentimes takes many years and can be extremely expensive. The idea of open sourcing of technology, I know you said, black market, but I would say that there are legitimate ways to get technology out without having to necessarily create a black market, would be to, if in this case, the appeal would be made to philanthropists that, look, here's a technology of merit. It's been assessed. Demonstrated to be robust and to have great promise. Now, could a philanthropist come forward with the needed funds to bring the technology through the engineering stages and out through the marketing distribution to bring an original prototype out into the market, but then also publish the plans for how to build that first prototype on the internet and put it into the brain trust of millions of people around the globe and let them, let people take that seed and use their own creativity, to improve upon it, to derivatize it into even better technologies that might have all number of useful applications. Now that's basically, sowing, seed in a fertile field now, and let the flowers bloom, rather than just planting one single tree somewhere in the middle of the orchard. Now you're planting seeds all over the orchard. So there definitely are ways of bringing technology out into the public domain that still benefits the inventor and has lots of opportunity for the inventor to be materially supported, because he would still be called upon as the prime consultant for so many other companies that might adopt the technology. You'll probably be invited to be on the boards of directors of companies, be asked to make media appearances, write a book about it, whatever. I mean, there's all kinds of ways for the inventor to be materially supported, despite essentially giving away the technology. And there's something very, very important to remember here about the way ideas gather strength. And that is this: ideas are strengthened as they're shared. So if you want something to really gain a tidal wave of momentum behind it, spread the word far and wide. Give the idea away. And that way it gets a huge amount of support under it. And this is where I think the real heroes of the coming energy revolution are going to be. They're the ones who don't feel attached to the financial implications of having a breakthrough technology, where they don't feel that they have to become the Bill Gates of new energy, but it's where they know that they are using their God-given creativity and their ability to work with other people as a team to do something that benefits a whole planet. And to me, what could be more satisfying than knowing that you're helping the healing of the whole earth? I mean, that there's rewards that go so far beyond money there. So those are some of the principles inside the open source concept.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Ramon, for calling.
Now,
have you heard of this young kid that created this nanotechnology and for solar? And I guess I can't remember what the percentage of, but he's just taken it off the scale. And with this new nanotechnology for solar, you could probably design a car and just paint the outside of it with it or whatever, and probably produce all the energy you needed for an electric car.
Well, there are a lot of exciting things going on in what's called thin film solar, James. And just like you mentioned, these new technologies, which are nanotech in nature, many of them are using some photosensitive pigments, like titanium dioxide is one that's used in a certain formulation, where these small particles are integrated into a type of coating that can be sprayed onto or printed on essentially a plastic film. And then that film can be used to be the outer skin of clothing. It could be used to roll onto rooftops, onto vehicles, any number of applications. And then have the electrical connectivity, to whatever devices are required. So we're definitely going to see a lot of these thin film solar type of technologies coming out. In fact, those are some that have been getting some of the venture capital I spoke about.
I think this kid's 12 years old and he's in Tiger, and can't remember how much he jumped up the efficiency of the solar, but it's pretty phenomenal. I believe we have another caller. Can you state your name and where you're from?
Yes, this is Ryan from Muncie, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a question for your guest. I was just curious to know, when do you think that Obama may release this information? And do you think that this will happen just because of the prices of gas and whatnot? It's such a it's creates so much money for so many people. Do you think this will come out soon? Do you think this will ever come out?
Well, I do believe it's going to come out soon. In fact, I believe 2009 is going to be a real watershed year for the advent of new technology. And one reason for that is because one of the technologies we've been following for some time that is truly revolutionary, it's called the black light power process, invented by Dr. Randall Mills back in Princeton, New Jersey. And you can certainly read about this just by going to blacklightpower.com. But the
the black light power process is one where taking a very common metal and hydrogen together and making a solid fuel out of it, essentially a metal hydride, and heating it inside a reactor that just looks kind of like a think of a large thermos is basically what the reactor looks like. By heating this thing up externally by using some amount of electrical input, heats up this solid fuel to the point where it vaporizes, and at a certain temperature, the metal catalyzes a reaction in the hydrogen gas. And what happens is that the hydrogen atom itself apparently shrinks. The mm-hmm. electron of the atom comes into a tighter orbit around the nucleus. And whenever that happens, whenever in any atom, whenever you have a collapse of the energy level of the electron, a tremendous amount of energy is released in the form of heat and light. In this case, with Randall Mills' process, it's called the black light power process, because not only does it release hundreds of times more energy in the form of heat compared mm-hmm. to the amount of electrical input that was required to heat up the device originally, it also produces some ultraviolet light, and thus it's called the black light power process. Now, Randall Mills has just, the Black Light Power Company, they just signed in mid-December their first commercial power license to a company in New Mexico, where that company now has the license to generate 500 megawatts of power, either in the form of heat or its electrical equivalent, using the black light power process. That's incredibly exciting news. It should have been on the front page of every paper and should have been the headliner for every news program in the country. Unfortunately, it wasn't.
Well, a lot of them should be that aren't, and it's disappointing. And my other question was also, do you think GM and other car companies will pick up on this and try to advertise this? And
well,
the
they are, you know, they are moving in that direction. I think if you look at any of the car ads now, you know, whether you see GM or you even see the oil companies, you see the Chevron ads, the BP ads, the Shell oil ads. I mean, they're all talking about embracing renewable energy, and it keeps it seems like every month they're adding another one to the list. I mean, first it was, you know, fuel cells for GM, now, you know, solar for Chevron, wind by Shell, you know, electric plug-in hybrids, you know, for some of these others. And now, gosh, one of them just announced that they're funding using algae as biofuel now, which we think is a very interesting technology, perhaps the most promising of the biofuel type of technologies is the use of algae. So certainly there are those within those organizations who are aware of some of these truly breakthrough type of technologies that we talk about in our book, Breakthrough Power. But, most of the people who work in these organizations have no clue about the existence of these technologies. Just like our U.S. Congress, several members of whom I met with over the last couple of years as an advocate for new legislation for breakthrough energy, you know, most of these members of Congress, they have no idea that
right.
these technologies are possible or that they exist. And
mm-hmm.
and generally speaking, the legislative staff that they rely on has no expertise or awareness of them either. It's one of the reasons why Gene Manning and I co-authored this book, was to be able to provide a primer, some basic education on what really is going on in the field of new energy, written in a way that you don't need a technical background or some degree in science to understand. It's very much written for mainstream layperson. Citizens of all kinds can can get the book and understand very readily what's going on. And having that education really empowers people to now stand up and exercise their voice and demand that we start to invest in these breakthrough technologies, because they are part of the toolbox that we need to open up to help correct mm-hmm. some of these imbalances we spoke about earlier.
You know, William Jan, age 12, and he was actually working out of Portland State and he has a scholarship there, and he's actually increased it. It says 500 times more light absorption than commercially available solar cells, and he said 500 times more than the cutting edge, and his kid seems like an amazing kid. He's got a black belt and, seems pretty focused. But he'd probably be a good person to get on your team there, being he's right there in Portland. He's in Beaverton, actually.
Well, I'll most definitely make that contact, James. Thanks for bringing him up. I think it goes to reinforce the point I made earlier about, we've got this whole new generation of young people who have remarkable gifts. Gifts to understand, to comprehend technology, where their own orientation toward the world is one of easy adaptation to things new, and I also believe that they have superior intuitive capabilities than generations that have preceded them. So they're here for a reason, and I think these young ones are here to accelerate the healing of our planet. It's needed.
Oh, definitely.
And they're capable, but they need mature, mm-hmm. responsible elders to help guide them so that they can direct their talents in a very constructive and helpful way, and to be loved and nurtured along the way. And if we do this, And we face our challenges and maturely collaborate together, there's just no end of promise for the human family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and do you think that maybe these technologies can be taught in universities and colleges, and maybe not even colleges, but just courses available in your area where
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. In fact, I know we have a university here in Oregon. I live in Portland, Oregon,
mm-hmm.
and one of the universities has just started, and in fact, just this past year, graduated its first degreed student in new energy technology, and in this case, most of the technologies that they're talking about are the conventional renewables, but that's a great foundation, and it can easily integrate some of these new emerging technologies of promise into their curriculum. And I think what you're going to find is that just like a lot of universities now have a nanotech a discipline inside their science and engineering programs, I think you're going to find the same thing for new energy. It's going to, because that's how you're going to attract students. And, it's going to be a major that people are going to want to engage in.
In the old days, what they used to do, I used to know this one kid, he said, I'm going to do my thesis on anti-gravity. And so he started doing research on it, and he told his professor, what he was going to do. And he asked him, he said, do you want to graduate? And he said, you better change your thesis. And, that's the way it used to be, but it's great to hear. I know Washington State is also opening up a lot of, at their universities, a lot of alternative things, and even programs where they have the professors, talking about UFOs and things like that. So
it's
really opening up.
Well, there's a changing of the guard that's occurring. Mm-hmm. Very clearly, it just happened on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. at the White House. I mean, there's a changing of a guard that's going on in the mainstream academia as well. And You know, and the time is right. You know, the times demand new ideas, new approaches, if we are to make the transition to the coming era that we all sense, or so many of us sense that there's a big change approaching. And we can make that change gracefully, or we can do it tumultuously. And I
right.
think that we're seeing lots of signs that, that people are going to be collaborating to do this in a high-minded way that's going to benefit all of us. I'm very hopeful of that. I'm an optimist, and mm-hmm. I really think that some incredible things are going to be happening. And
you know, the exopolitics people, I know Dr. Sala and Alfred Weber are both saying that they have a major push right now for bringing forward the anti-gravity technology and some of the fuel energy technology, and
mm-hmm.
and they've actually put a person in charge of that and to really bring that out into the public. So we'll see, you know, what happens. But they've been very open about, you know, bringing out these new technologies. And you know, there's a report called the Iron Mountain Report that a lot of people don't want to talk about, but
yeah.
it talks about the future, and it basically says the only thing that's going to pull this economy out of this major tailspin is some incredible new technology. And basically, it's here now. It's on the planet now. People have this technology. And
mm-hmm.
I think the trick is, okay, how do we, you know, get this into the mainstream, and how do we make this usable to the people versus, you know, continuing to just give it out little bits and pieces at a time.
YouTube. I think my suggestion would be YouTube, and I know, James, you talked about someone, I think, I'm not sure if it was India or in some part of that part of the world, where they're running their car on water and
mm-hmm.
flooding water and whatnot. And I was just wondering also, could this technology be used with airplanes and, you know, jets and the military?
It could be used everywhere. There's no end to the application of this energy.
Oh, yeah, there's, you know, I'll give you an example here. When I met with this physicist, Roger Stringham, at his home a couple nights ago in Kauai, you know, Roger, with his sonofusion process, in that process, a quarter of a cup of water
mm-hmm.
would power the average home for 100 years because it taps the inherent energy inside the hydrogen atom. And it's called sonofusion because it uses ultrasound to produce tiny little bubbles inside heavy water, what's called heavy water, which just basically means there's a the water, which is H2O, we've all heard of that. The
mm-hmm.
hydrogen that's in this water is an isotope of hydrogen that is a little heavier than the normal isotope that's in most common water. But basically, in the process, when these tiny little bubbles that are created by ultrasound, when those things collapse, they
mm-hmm.
extrude this very high-velocity jet of hot gas that gets implanted into what Roger calls a target foil. It's just a piece of metal foil that's very close to the source of the ultrasound. And when that hot gas implants into the target foil, there's a fusion reaction that happens. And those hydrogen atoms fuse into helium, just like what happens in a star like our sun, and in the process releases an enormous amount of energy in the form of heat. So
mm-hmm.
I've seen his process, I've gone over his data, I've looked at the reaction. In fact, I now have one of his little prototype sonofusion reactors in my kitchen. It's about the size of a man's wristwatch, and it's just fascinating. The technology is simple, it's elegant, it's repeatable, it works. And here's one of these guys who you know could be the next with his type of technology. But what he needs funding. He needs support. He needs a team of engineers to help build a device into something that can be put into the public domain as a commercial energy technology. Right now, it's kind of a benchtop demonstrator prototype, but it's very elegant. So I've been trying to help raise awareness of his technology as well as many other inventors. So the public can definitely get involved and have a hand in what in launching the new energy revolution.
How can people get a hold of you? We're running out of time. Unfortunately, we're at the end of the hour.
Yeah.
So if people want to get a hold of you, Joel, what would the best way for them to get a hold of you or share any further information with you?
Okay, the best way to do this is to go to our website, which is breakthroughpower.net. So go to breakthroughpower.net. You can read about our book, Breakthrough Power, How Quantum Leap New Energy Inventions Can Transform Our World. People can contact me through that website. They also can contact me by going to newenergymovement.org. Again, that's newenergymovement.org. And that is the nonprofit organization that I run that basically is set up to educate about the need for serious and urgent support for breakthrough energy technology.
All right. Well, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, Joel. I'm sure we'll be talking to each other real soon and working on some future projects here.
It's been my pleasure, James. Thank you very much.
All right. This is James Gunn with As You Wish Talk Radio signing off. Have a great evening and start watching the skies. There's a lot going on up there lately. Have a good evening. Good night.